everyone, it's Bud, and welcome to the latest episode of Before the Cheering Started, all about the journey to success and professional fulfillment. One of the great parts of being a journalist is learning, constantly learning, being introduced to people and ideas and work that had previously slipped through your personal cracks. Lee Carpenter is a critically acclaimed novelist. In her first act, she had a compelling 10-year career in magazine publishing, working for the likes of Francis Ford Coppola and John F. Kennedy Jr., and then working at the Paris Review in the aftermath of the death of the man who edited the magazine for 50 years, George Plimpton. Her novels explore the worlds of espionage, intelligence, undercover operations, perhaps influenced by her father's army intelligence work during World War II. This world, plus the theme of what's spoken and what's unspoken, is all over her new book, Ilium, which the New York Times called an unexpectedly moving novel. So, of course, the starting point for our conversation was a love that has come to her somewhat late in life, soccer.
Where do I begin? You know, I've been trying to write a sports book since I started writing. And I was very fixated on football at the beginning. I'm a big football fan. And then I shifted my focus to soccer a few years ago when my youngest started playing soccer, and I became a fan of the game through a child, which was new to me. You know, I grew up with football. I grew up with basketball. I grew up with tennis and to some extent ice hockey, but soccer met me late in life. And I think it might be my great love. And when I went to my book agent and said, I'm going to do a soccer book. He said, well, Lee, you know what people say about soccer. And I say, what do people say? And he said, it's the great American sport of the future and always will be. Or something like that. It was so, my older son graduated from his sort of school that only went to eighth grade. So he graduated from eighth grade last year. And as a graduation gift, my mother and I got together to get him a ticket to see Leo Messi play. So a long story short, there I am in Fort Lauderdale where Inter Miami plays. And, you know, I have friends who have daughters who talk about the experience of a Taylor Swift concert. Mm-hmm. Now we've all heard about it, but how it's, you know, almost a religious experience, and it's so communal and it's so much about girls coming together. I've not experienced that, but I can tell you for sure that an Inter Miami game is that for boys, and not to gender it, you know, it could be that for young girls who love soccer too, but the level of enthusiasm he has brought so far, and I think that's only going to continue to grow. And my oldest childhood friend actually is involved in MLS. And so I learned a bit about it from him. You know, I think it is a beautiful game. I mean, football's beautiful, but it's a bit more brutal and a bit more armored up. You know, you're really kind of watching gladiators when you're watching football. And I think when you're watching soccer, you're watching, you know, it's closer to watching ballet. So I'm in. Yeah. I don't know if I'll ever get the chance to write the book, but I think it's a great game. What do you think?
I agree. One of the last guests on the podcast was the writer Nick Hornby, who did okay with Fever Pitch. And the beauty of Fever Pitch is I remember I read it when it came out and I didn't know who any of the players were, and it did not matter because it was about the story and characters in that story. So I think the world is ready for another soccer book.
Yeah. And I think I'm a woman, so maybe I'll look at it a little bit differently.
So if you, and I would look forward to that, do indeed write a soccer book, it might come under the heading of, if not write what you know, but you know, write what you are experiencing, maybe through your sons. Are the books that you have written, especially this latest one, are they some sense or write what you know, or write what you aspire to know because in part of your father's World War II experience?
Well, you know, two things. The first thing is when I started thinking about writing about football and now thinking about soccer, I felt that that subject was completely in line with everything I've ever written, because what I have essentially been writing about since I started 10 years ago and in these three books, above all, I've been writing stories of people in exceptional circumstances doing very high level, often very physical work. You know, my first book really looked at the special operations community. That was 11 days. My second book, Red, White, Blue, really was about CIA and China. And this book, you know, as you know, is more of meant to be more of like a classic espionage thriller. But as you'll see, if you get to the end of the book, it's really about a group of warriors who've grown up together, experienced loss together, and have to reckon with that loss through this sort of long operation that plays out over many years. So in that way, I've really written about what I absolutely do not know. Mm-hmm. But what my now point two to my father, what my father knew, but I never knew he knew, you know, and it wasn't because he kept a secret. There was nothing sort of exciting, like a secret, which can be very exciting. It was more that I was born when he was in his late 50s. He and my mother had a big age difference. So by the time I was old enough, so when is one old enough? Maybe 16 or 17. By the time I was old enough to really talk to him as a young adult, it never occurred to me to say, hey, what were you doing 50 years ago? Right. Or even, because I later learned he stayed in the military, you know, kind of through the Korean War. Well, what were you doing 40 years ago? Nor did I have any interest in that subject matter. So I knew, oh, he'd served his country. But it was only many, many years later, and really ultimately not until after he died, that I started really leaning into reading books in what I'll call the war genre, a genre largely written, as I like to say, by men, for men, and about men. And nothing sexist about that, rather sort of a supply and demand issue that men, I think, traditionally have fought in wars. And so they have been the ones to tell their stories, and men have been the ones to seek out these stories. Of course, that's all changed in the post 9/11 wars. But I was really looking for my dad. You know, after he died, I really could not believe that he had had a period in his life. You know, I was looking after 9/11, I'm looking at my peers, my generation, going off to serve in these wars. And I'm realizing, hey, I had a guy in my house, and it was my father who had enormous insight into this kind of thing. And I never talked to him about it. I don't think my mother talked to him about it either, really. And again, it was just our own, I think narcissism is probably too strong a word, but I now, if I have one sort of mission that I pursue in life casually, I tell all of my friends and all the folks I meet through work, because that's kind of the, you know, to the extent that I have a social network, it's largely in the veterans community. And I, you know, and my husband was a Marine, I tell people, write it down, you know, even if you're in a highly, you know, classified line of work. I said, you know, you're going to have a child or a grandchild, not in a year, but in 30, 40 years, ask you, what was it like? You know, what was it like in Fallujah in 2004? What was it like in Damascus in 2008? And if you're sitting there and you're in your 70s, as my father was, if I had known to ask him, you might not remember. I have written almost exclusively about what I don't know, but what I try and bring into my stories is emotion. And, you know, I've learned a little bit about that just by being a human being.
You mentioned that this is a genre, or especially writing about war, is written by men, about men, and so on. In this book, a very prominent and complex, interesting female character. Is that by intention?
It is by intention. And you'll see there's another complex female character who comes onto the scene. I had the great privilege of working with a guy called Stephen Cornwell. Stephen Cornwell during COVID. So I spent most of COVID on a project working for him. He's a film producer, and he's the son of David Cornwell, whose pen name was John Le Carré. So he's John Le Carré's son, and he does all of the adapting Le Carré books into film and television. And he talked, his father later died, sadly. John Le Carré died last year, but he was still alive then when I was working with Stephen. And Stephen talked about his father all the time. So I would get these sort of little Le Carré pearls of wisdom from him. You know, Le Carré thinks, you know, enter a scene as late as possible. Le Carré thinks this about story architecture. And I think I came out of that experience really wanting to write something that felt like a classic thriller, not unlike the Le Carré books, which I love, do. Le Carré was criticized for not having more female characters, mm-hmm. but one of his great female characters is a character called Charlie, who's a young British actress who's sort of the central character in The Little Drummer Girl. And The Little Drummer Girl had a huge influence on me and on this book, because the idea there is that the asset, the human asset, the person pulled into an operation, sometimes begins to empathize with the quote unquote enemy. And that part of that book always stayed with me, and empathizing with enemies is sort of a through line of all my work, I think. And so I wanted the character of a woman who starts out with a lot of knowledge because she's looking back on her younger self, but not a lot of agency. And if I did my job, by the end of the book, you'll see she is capable of making very strong choices. But yes, there are the conventional wisdom, I guess I would say, about espionage, and I think it's conventional wisdom for a reason, is that there are not a lot of strong women characters. Where's the female James Bond? Where's the female Jason Bourne? I get those questions quite often. And they're not easy to answer. I think people have tried to write female iterations of those great male spies, and I don't know if they've worked. There's a great book series by McCarran called The Slow Horses series. I don't know if you've looked at that, and it's now a TV show on Apple, which is fantastic, written by one of the great TV writers of all time, in my opinion, Will Smith, not to be confused with the actor Will Smith. But that series and that television series has a great female character, Diana Taverner, who's sort of, in the series, the head of Britain's MI5. But yes, the quest to bring more women into espionage is, in a funny, not funny way, mirrored by the quest to bring more women into espionage, you know, in the real world. But women are certainly in espionage at the very highest levels at CIA and our sort of partner organizations.
You had a long career in publishing. And I chuckled when I've read about this, in publishing Francis Ford Coppola's magazine. And yes,
Francis Coppola, who's just, I mean, where to begin with him? He's such a, I was so lucky to have any interaction with him when I was so young. And he hired one woman to run this magazine, Adrienne Brodeur, who's just continues to be a mentor and close friend of mine. And she hired me basically to make her coffee. But I stuck around long enough that, you know, I ended up doing more than making the coffee. And that was just a foundational experience.
And then you work at George, you know, the well-known JFK Jr. project, which I'm sure there's a whole, you know, weekends long conversation just about that experience.
That was brief. That was an internship. I think I was there for 3 months right out of college. And I went from there to work for Adrian and work for Zoetrope, which is what I really wanted to do. Listen, again, you kind of, it's so hard to know what you're doing when you're going through it. Much easier to look back. Right. And I felt at that time, and for a long time, that I was just failing. But the greatest thing about George was, I mean, John Kennedy Jr. was a terrific and very kind man. I think he was, as many people have said, you know, ahead of his time. You know, I remember when Morning Joe kind of came on the scene and got popular, and I thought, this is what John dreamed about. It was this intersection of politics and culture. You can have Chuck Schumer on, and then you can have Bradley Cooper on. Why not? But at the time, it was a challenge. And actually what we did at Zoetrope was also kind of pushing a boundary, because we were commissioning fiction, which Coppola was then optioning for his film company. And people felt, it's so quaint to think about it now, but people felt at the time that commissioning fiction was sort of dirty. You know, you don't tell a writer, you know, what story to write. The writer needs to sit in his genius and come up with a story. But we felt we were supporting writers by paying them more than other small magazines were. So I would say in both of those cases, I was working for entities that were trying to do things differently within a conventional structure, a magazine structure, a literary magazine structure, but both were fundamentally trying to do something differently. And that's always something you learn from.
And so when you're working at those places, and Paris Review as well, yes?
Oh, yeah. And then I grew up and I went to the Paris Review and found that was a very specific experience, because I arrived there not long after George Plimpton had died. Right. So I like to say that, you know, I could tell people I was going to try and, you know, lead this very small, you know, literary magazine. But in fact, I was just sort of walking into the living room of a family in mourning. Oh. I walked in and the whole team that was there probably didn't want me there. They were so talented, these editors, and they, you know, they'd lost their father. And it was, so that was what defined that experience above all, was everyone was trying to get over, you know, it was like the quarterback was gone. The quarterback, the coach, and the owner combined in one man was gone.
Suffice it to say, that was not an easy situation to walk into.
It was not. I said later that when I took that job, everyone who knew me and sort of in my family said, Lee, perfect job for you. You're going to be in this job for life. You know, it was like I had the perfect boyfriend, but then I would go home and he would, you know, shoot up heroin and treat me poorly, because it was kind of like a great job on the surface, but it was, yes, complex emotionally. So, but it was, you know, I learned a lot, as one does. I left. I failed to make that my life's work. It wasn't the right place for me. But I learned so much when I was there. And that was really the transformational pivot. When I left the Paris Review, I sort of thought, I'm done with this period of my life. I'm done with publishing. I want to do something different.
During the course of not just the Paris Review, but being at George and being at the Francis Ford Coppola magazine as well, is there like a gnawing sense of there's something more out there that I want to do? Or did that only kind of come to you at the end of your time in the magazine publishing world?
When I left the Paris Review, I mean, I've been encouraged not to call it a failure. But the truth of the matter is, a new editor came in, who's a terrific writer, and he sort of came in and said, you know, I don't need you. You know, I don't need you. I'll be the editor and the publisher and I'll run this and I don't need you. And so what I thought was the beginning of a beautiful friendship was a very abrupt ending to my tenure there. And, you know, at the time, and for many years after, I sort of thought, you know, I was just fired by one of the most celebrated living writers. And what I realized later was it had absolutely nothing to do with me. I think he had to probably negotiate me out to get a bigger salary or whatever the reasons were, they were not personal. But when I left that experience, I thought, you know, I'm done. You know, where am I going to go from here? I'd gone to graduate school. I'd kind of come away from graduate school into the Paris Review thinking, you know, I'd achieved something I had a lot of goals there, none of which I hit because I was let go. And I sort of turned away. And it was at that point that I'm from Delaware. It was at that point that I went to start to work with the Attorney General for the state of Delaware at the time, Beau Biden. And my other passion in life was politics. I mean, the reason I ended up at George was I'd spent summers working for then Senator Joe Biden, you know, in high school and college. And I sort of thought after college, I'm going to Washington or I'm going to do something with writing. And it was my mother read an item in People magazine about George, the launch of George. And in her inimitable way, you know, she sort of cut out the article and sent it to me and said, this looks perfect for you. You know, it's politics and writing. And that's how I got to George. And then by the time I was kind of in it at George, I thought, well, now I'm in publishing. You know, while I was there, I applied to grad school. And so I was already on the path to do that. But anyway, I leave the Paris Review. I'm like, I'm done. I'm going back to politics. I knew one politician, that was Beau. And I went to him and said, you know, I have a newborn and I want to come home to Delaware and I want to work with you and let's write speeches together. You're going to run for governor. I can write a book for you. I know how to do that, or I can help you with that piece of your puzzle. And he agreed, and we started working together. And his wife was one of my dearest childhood friends, and then I was for a brief shining moment. I thought, I found it. You know, I found my path. I learned in publishing. This is where I am meant to be. I love this guy. He's an amazing politician. I love his politics. I'm going to work with him for the rest of my life. And then there was a whole nother set of dreams and goals and things we talked about doing together. And I believed, and I think I can speak for most of the people around Beau, we all believed, he's got what it takes. I mean, of course, he had the legacy of his father having served. I don't think at that time I ever could have imagined that his father would be president. But if you'd asked me then, I might have said, hey, Beau will be the one running in 2020. Then Beau had a stroke. And after he had the stroke, our book project, which we had found a publisher for, was sort of put on hold. And the literary agent who was helping with Beau's book took me to lunch and said, look, Lee, you should write your own book. It will only be additive to your career with Beau and to Beau and to the book with Beau, because if you write a book under your own name, your name will only be helpful in, you know, in selling the other project. I sort of said, that's ridiculous. But this agent wouldn't let me go. He finally said, if you write 10,000 words under your own name and I like them, I'll take you on as a client. He later died of cancer, but I owe my writing life to him and to some extent to Beau, because I started writing at that time. So I started writing and I thought, what am I going to write about? Well, maybe I'll try and figure out what it felt like to be my father when he joined into this, what we would now call a special mission unit. So I kind of looked around and said, well, what's a special mission unit today in 2010? And I kind of stumbled onto Naval Special Warfare, which was a very obscure thing at the time. I mean, no one knew really what Naval Special Warfare was in 2010. And then after May 2011 and the raid that killed Osama bin Laden, a lot of people knew. I started writing that book, and it was just an accident that it was set in that community and that I'd read every book out there on Navy SEALs so I could seem credible. And in June 2011, we took that first chapter into Knopf. They bought it. I remember I ran into Sunny Mehta in the hallway, you know, who I'd met when I was 21 and working at George Magazine. And he said, you know, Lee, we always thought you'd write a book. I thought, that's so not true. Nobody ever thought I could write a book. But anyway, and then 11 days, then Beau was diagnosed with brain cancer. 11 days was published in June of 2013. Beau got the cancer diagnosis that August 2013. And at that point, you know, again, it was, what am I, okay, what, who am I, what am I doing? I'm not a writer. And the question at that time was, do I want to work in politics, or did I just want to work for this one politician? And I think at that point, I realized that I'd been following people much more than I'd been following industries or any career. From the moment I, you know, told my parents I was applying for an internship in Senator Biden's office, I was following people. I was following, you know, John F. Kennedy Jr.'s dream. I was following other people's dreams that I thought were interesting, where I might be able to add something. But it wasn't like I wanted to work in magazines. I wanted to work for George, or in literary magazines. I wanted to work on that launch project, or in politics. I don't know if that says something good or bad about me. But then suddenly you're all grown up, and you look around and you think, maybe I should just try and do something on my own. Maybe I should try and lead a project. And when 11 Days did okay, my editor, Shelley Wanger at Knopf, to whom I owe so much, sort of said, why don't you write another book? So that was the beginning of the path that I've now been on for 10 years, which is writing as a profession. But certainly I would never have had the nerve to even say I wanted to do that much, much earlier in my career.
I am fascinated by people who are in positions that 99.999% of the rest of us are not in or will never be in. And without getting into politics, we see the Bidens and their family history and all that's transpired and the tragic death of Bo Biden. We see it kicked around as a political football.
It's devastating.
What is it like to try and deal with that or view that from the vantage point of you worked for him, you had a connection to him? Again, what is it like to have a personal connection to something that is incredibly impersonal, the discussion in the body politic of the Bidens, when those two things are happening at the same time?
You know, I love that family dearly, and I am, I think, like everyone else in this country, and I love this country, and I'm sad that the discourse has become so rancorous. And I remember a time when it was not that way, and that's what makes it so poignant. I think it's been brutal, and you have to remember that there are children here in this story too. They're very young. I mean, Joe Biden's grandchildren are older now, but his youngest is very, very young, and I think that's where I wish people would take a bit of a step back, you know. Yeah. Criticize the policies, but can we not leave the people alone? And no one really seems to be able to do that. If you have not lost a family member, it's maybe take a beat before you go in. You know, Joe Biden was defined even before losing Bo, was so defined by loss. Mm-hmm. You know, empathy was kind of the key that he played really well in. And anyhow, so it makes me sad.
When you first started writing, how much did the element of doubt play a role? Did you have a sense like I might have something here, or is it all kind of a crapshoot? I'm going to write what I write, and who knows if there's going to be an audience for it?
Doubt plays a huge role. Someone shared with me very early on, I think it was when I was working on those 10,000 words, a little clip. And there's also a video, I don't know if you've seen it, but it's Ira Glass talking about the relationship between, I'm sure I'm going to botch this, but my memory of it is, it's Ira Glass talking about the relationship between taste and talent. And what he says is that most people who set out to do something creative do so because they have a level of taste. They want to go make movies because they've seen 100 movies that they love. They want to write books because they've read 100 books that they love. They want to play tennis because they've watched Rafael Nadal growing up. And then what happens is they set out and they realize very quickly, oh my God, I'm not Rafael Nadal. And that's because your talent has not met up with your taste. And guess what? It takes a long time. And he says, Glass says, again, my recollection, that again, 99.9% of people who set out to do something like crash on the rocks of that divide between taste and talent. They have too much taste. So they look at their own work and they know it's garbage. And he says, you have to really move through that. Maybe you never get through, but if you don't give yourself the time to at least give talent a chance to at least get in the same ballpark as your taste, you're doing yourself a disservice. And, you know, it's kind of like Gladwell's 10,000 hours. You know, after my father died, my mother found a page in his desk drawer. It was the first page of a book, of a novel that he never finished, but he wrote that first page. And, you know, he never saw me write a page, but I'm glad I've stuck with it. And I do think I've learned to be a better, I know I've learned to be a better writer. I look back and can see mistakes that I made. So I do think it takes time, but I did used to think, oh, some fairy, the writer fairy godmother comes down and taps you on the shoulder and says, you're allowed to do it. As recently as this morning, I said to our mutual friend, Paul Bogards, you know, what am I doing? So I think the doubt never quite leaves you, but I think it can be a killer in the beginning, that doubt. And I think for anyone who's ever achieved anything early on in life, that also can be a roadblock. I think early success can be a critical impairment to later success. Back to loss, just for a moment. You know, I lost my father, you know, my literary agent, who I loved dearly, Ed Victor, who was like a second father, died of cancer. I had had enough loss by the time I sort of said, "Hey, I'm going to give writing a shot." I had, ironically, developed an appetite for risk that I'd never had before. I didn't need to take on a sure thing, which if you look at the first 10 years of my career, I mean, what's not sure about going to work for JFK Jr.? What's not sure about going to work for Francis Coppola? You know, I could have as easily gone to work for Ford and GM, mm-hmm. you know, or Coke and Pepsi, or today, TikTok and Snapchat. Like I was aligning myself with brands that were secure, you know, and I fought hard to get those jobs. You know, you can ask anyone I ever worked with, but when you have to jump off the diving board all on your own with no brand, it's a very different kind of experience. And I know when I did that with 11 Days, I sort of thought, what do I have to lose? You know, bring it on, critics, slaughter me, let this book sell nothing, let it be an abject failure. I can take it. You know, I've lost my father. I've lost my friend. You know, what is the value of career success after you've been through that? Of course, you let go. And then for the first time, I sort of did something completely on my own that, you know, that people felt worked out, but it was coming out of a place of that, those losses, I think.
You say it worked out and the, you know, critics slaughter me. Well, the critic from the New York Times, I don't believe she slaughtered you. I believe she was an extraordinarily gifted writer. And Toni Morrison, who knows a thing or two about writing, used the quote, eloquent prose. So
that was amazing. That was amazing. And yeah.
Remember where you were?
When I heard about the Kakutani or the Morrison?
Either.
I heard about the Kakutani. I was actually in the Knopf office. And Michiko Kakutani, for anyone listening who doesn't know, was, you know, the the 800-pound gorilla in the book world when it comes to critical writing, and so terrific. Even to get her to write about you if she wasn't going to like your book was considered an achievement at that time. And she really took an interest in books about these wars. I don't know if that's why she picked up 11 Days, because it was by a writer no one had ever heard of, Lee Carpenter, but she reviewed many, many books kind of in that space before she stopped writing for the Times. And I remember, I think I was with my editor, Shelley, when I saw that review, and I couldn't believe it. It was really humbling, and it certainly was something that at the time allowed me to allow myself to keep going, to think, okay, if Michiko Kakutani says it's okay, I can keep going. And then Toni Morrison I had the great, incredible privilege of meeting her. She was just a remarkable person, to say nothing of her writing. And I remember when COVID hit, the New Yorker magazine did a long interview with Fran Lebowitz, who was very close to Toni Morrison. And in that interview, Fran Lebowitz talks about her long, long phone calls with Toni Morrison. And to have those two, I probably could have retired and, you know, gone and worked at private equity or something. But, but it was nice. No, it was just when you get the praise, it's great. But I've also been kicked in the teeth several times over the last 10 years. And you just have to kind of take the good with the bad and keep pushing through.
Lee Carpenter. Her new novel is called Ilium, and it's a terrific read. The book reads like a movie, so it's not surprising to hear that there's a deal in the works to make it just that. Before the Cheering Started is a production of June 14th Productions and Gemini 13 Productions. This episode was created and written by me. Guitar playing, that's me as well. No extra charge. I'm Bud Mishkin, and this is Before the Cheering Started. Thanks for joining us on the journey.